Today is Wednesday, September 23rd, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the European Union proposes a new migrant policy.
Migration is complex. The old system to deal with it in Europe no longer works.
Also ahead, the U.S. passes 200,000 COVID-19 deaths, plus how some undocumented immigrants are encouraging U.S. citizens to vote. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Europe. European Union officials proposed an overhaul to the bloc's migration policy Wednesday. The new so-called Migration and Asylum Pact follows the devastating fire in the Moria refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. It's the latest effort by the EU's executive arm to create a comprehensive plan for managing migration and to get all 27 member states behind it. The long-awaited migration plan includes mandatory rules for all EU countries to assist with migrants to Europe while sending illegal migrants back to their home countries. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
Migration has always been a fact for Europe, and it will always be. Migration is complex. The old system to deal with it in Europe no longer works. The Commission's package on migration and asylum, which we present today, offers a fresh start. This package reflects a fair and reasonable balance between responsibility and solidarity among member states. We all share the benefits. We all share the burden.
For more on the new policy proposals, I spoke to journalist Catherine Field in Paris, who has been following the story.
The major proposal that has come from today's announcement has been that the European Union is moving away from the system it had of relocating asylum seekers around different parts of the 27 members, so as each country would have the same percentage of would-be migrants as any other country. So they've moved very firmly away from that. And what they're looking at now is having more camps, but on the borders. So they're looking at having screening centres on the borders that will be faster screening, that will be set up and will be in place as soon as they can do it, and that they are allowing for a five-day period at the borders where people, would-be migrants, will be interviewed, they'll have health checks, and it's there that they will decide whether those would-be asylum seekers will be allowed to travel on into the European Union.
This seems like quite an overhaul of the EU's migration policy.
It is indeed. It's a major overhaul. It means that what the EU is hoping is that countries previously that opposed having to take asylum seekers won't now be forced to take in would-be asylum seekers. It's providing them now with the possibility of helping in other ways. So, for example, if a country doesn't want to take any would-be asylum seekers, they can help by providing logistical support or material support to send back to third countries or to home countries those people whose applications have received a negative response. That's really been the question over the last couple of years is, yes, people do get a fair hearing when they come to Europe, but the question is, they don't get sent back. They say that around two-thirds of those arrivals get a negative response, and it's sometimes difficult or a lengthy procedure to get them to return. So this would, in a way, quicken the returns and allow countries that are just so opposed to having would-be asylum seekers on their territory that they can, for example, send a plane. They can also provide border guards, police for any sorts of returns. And it's there where you see the major change in this.
Now, this is a proposed policy. So what happens next?
There still has to be a vote. It still has to be approved by all of the member countries. All 27 have to agree to it. So we're going to have that debate. It's going to come up at the European Summit next week. So there's a lot of toing and froing still to go. There are Indeed, questions already being raised, particularly by a group of NGOs who said, well, it's all very well to have these structures at the borders, but that means that you're going to have to put in judicial infrastructure at these centres. You're going to have to make sure that you have the right lawyers ready to go through these papers. You're going to have to make sure that a process that lasts only 5 days maximum, is that fair? These are the sort of questions that are going to come up. You're also going to have the big question of, this really doesn't change much for countries such as Greece or Italy that are really on the front line of these new arrivals from various parts around the world. It still means that Greece and Italy will have to deal with this influx. So there's a lot of work to be done. But one thing that they do say is that this isn't 2015 anymore. In 2015, think back, the European Union saw 1.8 million arrivals on their territory. Last year, 2019, it was 140,000. So far this year, 55,000.
That was journalist Catherine Field in Paris. In New York, today is day two of speeches by heads of state at the United Nations General Assembly. COVID-19, conflict, and climate change are at the top of the agenda. Yesterday's speeches included sharp accusations by U.S. President Donald Trump against China for its handling of the coronavirus outbreak, which China's leader Xi Jinping rebuffed. In his remarks, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a global ceasefire and avoiding a cold war between the U.S. and China. For an update from New York, earlier today I spoke to VOA U.N. correspondent Margaret Bashir.
On Tuesday, the U.N. General Assembly annual debate kicked off, and that first morning is always a very action-packed one. There was a lot of talk about COVID. Today, the second day of the debate, there's a lot of Middle Eastern leaders speaking. So I think, for instance, in the morning, we're going to hear from Saudi Arabia, a major regional power in the Middle East, from Iraq, from Lebanon, which, you know, is going through a political and economic crisis right now. In the afternoon, we're going to hear from Afghanistan. So I think we're going to hear more about peace processes. We'll certainly still hear about COVID.
Another big topic is climate change. What's been said about that?
Climate change is a major marquee issue of the United Nations. The Secretary General opened his speech about it yesterday when he gave sort of his state of the world when he addresses the opening session. You know, he said the world is burning, and he sees the COVID crisis as an opportunity for climate, also for climate action, because we're going to have to rebuild economically and socially and so many different ways because of COVID, because of all the impacts that's had across societies. And he's saying we need to incorporate mitigation for climate change into our recovery from COVID. So he sees the two things being interlinked and being an opportunity. We also heard from President Macron of France on Tuesday, and his country helped shepherd the Paris Climate Accord of 2015, which is coming up on its fifth anniversary in December. And Macron said we need to seize this fifth anniversary to regenerate some of that earlier momentum and excitement about climate. And we need to get to these goals of carbon neutrality and lowering greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, of course, all of this is being done virtually. How is that going? Any issues or glitches so far?
So it was kind of funny because the first speech of the world leaders on Tuesday morning is always Brazil. It's sort of a traditional thing. Brazil speaks first, but the Brazilian president was speaking and he had subtitles on his video message, but there was no translation. And then all of a sudden, about a minute and a half into his speech, you got color bars on the screen and wobbly noises and he disappeared. And I was like, uh-oh, a minute and a half and we're already having technical problems. And they brought it back and started it again. So there was a little glitch at the beginning, but I have to say it actually ran much smoother than I expected because we've been doing a lot of Zoom-like meetings at the United Nations for many months now. The UN Security Council holds virtual meetings and the UN General Assembly has held a few, and they've been rife with glitches, technical problems. And, you know, 6 months into this crisis, if you think people would know to make sure they mute their microphones, but they don't still know. So, but despite it all, they've done a pretty good job so far with the technical end of it.
That was VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. North Korea is preparing to hold a major military parade next month. Some analysts expect Pyongyang may unveil major new weapons. VOA's Bill Gallo has the latest indications about what those weapons may be.
October 10th is a major holiday in North Korea. It's the 75th anniversary of the ruling Workers' Party. And North Korea is apparently planning a big parade. Commercial satellite photos suggest the North has been rehearsing for weeks at a parade training facility outside the Capitol. On Tuesday, the website 38 North said part of those preparations appear to involve a missile-related vehicle. The organization does not know for sure what the vehicle is, but says it appears to be large enough to fit an intercontinental ballistic missile, meaning it could be an ICBM mobile launcher. Some analysts predict North Korea may unveil a new solid-fuel ICBM at the parade. Others say Pyongyang could soon showcase a submarine-launched ballistic missile. Either would add an unpredictable new component to North Korea's arsenal. Solid fuel missiles are easier to transport and take less time to prepare for launch. Submarine launch missiles are also mobile and easier to hide. A major display of military power could be seen as a provocation just weeks ahead of the U.S. presidential election. U.S. President Donald Trump says he has no problem with North Korea's short-range launches, but he may object to a bigger move. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been discharged from hospital in Berlin. He had been airlifted there for treatments for what the German government says was a poisoning with the Soviet-developed Novichok nerve agent. Russian authorities are accused of carrying out the poisoning, charges the Kremlin denies. Emmer McCarthy of Reuters reports.
After 32 days, including 24 spent in intensive care, the prominent Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny has been discharged from the hospital over his suspected poisoning. The charity hospital in Berlin said in a statement, quote, the patient's condition had improved sufficiently for him to be discharged from acute inpatient care. Navalny was airlifted from Russia to Berlin while still in a coma, and the German government says tests in Germany, France and Sweden have determined he was poisoned with a Soviet-era Novichok nerve agent, the same chemical used to poison former spy Sergei Skripal in the UK. Moscow has said it is yet to see evidence of a crime and has declined to open an investigation so far, instead opening a pre-investigation probe, and the Kremlin has denied any involvement. The hospital says complete recovery is possible for Navalny. However, it remains too early to gauge the potential long-term effects. In Instagram posts this week, Navalny said he had difficulties using his phone, pouring water or climbing stairs because his hands failed him and his legs trembled. He's also called for Russia to hand over the clothes he was wearing when he first fell ill, what he calls an important piece of evidence in his case.
That was Emmer McCarthy of Reuters. This is VOA. President Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus was sworn in for a new term on Wednesday, the official news agency Belta said, in a sudden inauguration conducted with no prior announcement. The ceremony, which would normally be publicized in advance as a major state occasion, follows a disputed election on August 9th in which Lukashenko, in power since 1994, claimed a landslide victory. The opposition accused him of massive vote rigging. Hundreds of thousands have since protested, calling for him to step down. Belarusian security forces have cracked down on the protests with hundreds of arrests and accusations of torture. Some opposition leaders have fled to neighboring countries. Beijing responded Wednesday to a move by U.S. lawmakers to ban imports from China's northwestern Xinjiang region. The U.S. House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly on Tuesday in favor of banning imports due to accusations of enslavement of the region's Uyghur Muslim population. On Wednesday, Beijing called the accusations a, quote, fabricated lie, end quote, intended to hurt Chinese businesses. Activists say more than 1 million Uyghurs and other mostly Muslim Turkic-speaking people have been incarcerated in camps, AFP reports. The Swedish clothing giant H&M said this month it was ending its relationship with a Chinese yarn producer over the labor accusations. U.S. immigration authorities say they have stopped sending detained migrant women to a gynecologist who is accused of performing forced sterilizations. A U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, spokesman said Dr. Mahendra Amin would no longer see patients, the AP reports. Amin faces allegations that he administered hysterectomies and other procedures on women held at a migrant prison in the state of Georgia. Amid the accusations, activists are calling for the prison to be shut down and for ICE to be abolished. Government investigations into the alleged abuses are ongoing. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The U.S. marks a grim milestone as COVID-19 deaths passed 200,000 yesterday. It's the highest death toll in the world from the disease. In Washington, D.C., mourners placed 20,000 small U.S. flags, each representing 10 Americans killed by COVID, around the Washington Monument, which stands across from the White House. Health experts say the death toll could continue to increase by tens of thousands in the coming months. AP's Julie Walker has more.
The U.S. surpassed 200,000 coronavirus deaths yesterday. That's equivalent to a 9/11 attack every day for 67 days. Dr. Anthony Fauci calls the 200,000 U.S. deaths stunning. Sadly, that number is still climbing. Deaths are running at close to 770 a day on average, and a widely cited model from the University of Washington predicts the U.S. toll will double to 400,000 by the end of the year as schools and colleges reopen and cold weather sets in. A vaccine is unlikely to become widely available until next year. The Johns Hopkins numbers are supplied by states, but the real toll is thought to be much higher, in part because many coronavirus deaths were probably ascribed to other causes, especially early on before widespread testing. I'm Julie Walker.
Doctors and public health experts are telling people in the Northern Hemisphere to prepare for the worst in the coming months, when both the coronavirus and the flu virus will be circulating at the same time. It's a 1-2 punch that could cause even more deaths and has the potential to overwhelm healthcare systems. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Doctors say it's more important to get a flu shot this year than ever before. The CDC says anyone 6 months or older should get the vaccine. Dr. Susan Rehm specializes in infectious disease at Cleveland Clinic.
We anticipate that there will be some people coming up who have both COVID and influenza at the same time, which would be very devastating, obviously, and increase the risk of death from one or both of them. So anything we can do to prevent influenza and to prevent COVID, of course, we want to do.
Both are respiratory viruses. Both can be lethal. And flu season is practically here. Lavanya Vasudevan is a community and health professor at Duke University.
We are going into this flu season with both hands tied behind our back. And we are also working in a climate where trust in vaccines continues to erode.
The CDC reports a sharp drop in routine childhood immunizations because people are afraid of getting COVID-19. But doctors say there is nothing to fear. Dr. Susan Rehm.
All of the healthcare facilities are taking extra precautions to make the environment safe for people who come in.
Even when there isn't a pandemic, Professor Vasudevan says people justify opting out of getting a flu shot.
The flu vaccine is not always the most effective vaccine, so people use that as an excuse to not get the vaccine.
Professor Thomas Denny heads the Duke Human Vaccine Institute.
In recent years, we've been anywhere from probably a low number of 20% hit, and we've been as high as 60, 65% successes.
Experts say even an imperfect vaccine can reduce the severity of infection.
There are also a number of myths associated with the flu vaccine, like getting the flu vaccine will actually give you the flu, which is not possible because the virus particles in the flu shot are dead, so they cannot multiply and give you infection.
CDC data shows that during past flu seasons, 80% of children who died from influenza were not vaccinated. And research from Duke University shows only a third of American adults got a flu shot in 2018. Young children, pregnant women, older adults, and people with underlying conditions are most at risk for hospitalization or death from a flu infection. African Americans and other minorities have a higher risk as well.
It worries me a lot that communities that are the hardest hit by COVID are also very heavily impacted by flu. And we know that vaccination rates are lower in these communities.
Vasudevan says doctors need to work with community leaders to let people know that the flu vaccine can save lives. She says the vaccines also have to be accessible and free of charge. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
24-year-old Maria Jose Rodriguez is not a citizen of the United States, so she can't vote in November's election. But that hasn't stopped her from mobilizing and advocating in her community. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
Walking the streets of Coachella, California, Maria Jose Rodriguez is canvassing for an election in which she can't vote. Rodriguez is 24 years old enough to cast a ballot, but her immigration status means she can't take part. That's not stopping her from a mission, though, to mobilize her community to get out and vote.
It feels like you're shouting at the top of your lungs, but nobody can hear you, you know, because I know for a lot of undocumented people, it's kind of normalized for us to be like in the shadows, you know, just keep your head down, go to work, mind your own business.
Coachella is an area largely home to Latinos and mixed status families. Rodriguez herself was born in Michoacán, Mexico, and brought into the U.S. when she was four. Her status under Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, gives temporary relief from deportation for some young undocumented immigrants, and it allows them authorization for work. Rodriguez is able to get a job and go to school, and she's currently pursuing a career in psychology at UC Riverside. But she says being shut out of decisions that affect all Americans is disheartening. Fellow canvasser Vanessa Moreno is also a DACA beneficiary, and she agrees it's not easy.
It is frustrating because it's that, you know, like that paper, that just piece of paper that is preventing me from, you know, voting. But I feel I'm also hopeful that in the future I will vote, and I know that. But I know right now I'm not going to wait for that moment. I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that other communities are voting.
Leslie Figueroa is running for mayor of the city of Coachella in November. She says that the work that Rodriguez and Moreno are doing as volunteers in her campaign is critical, since historically the region has a low voter turnout.
It means a lot to me for them to be so active and so, you know, wanting to make sure that other residents who can vote participate in their local democracy, right?
And Moreno has a message for U.S. President Donald Trump. She says people like her make up a movement that he may have underestimated.
We can vote, but we have a voice, and we are able to use our voice to push others, to motivate others to vote for us.
Thanks to Reuters' Libby Hogan for that report. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has brokered two historic peace agreements in the Middle East, the most recent one between Israel and Bahrain. The first was between Israel and United Arab Emirates. In the spirit of peace and cooperation, Bahrain has agreed to normalize its diplomatic relations with Israel. They will exchange embassies and ambassadors, begin direct flights between their countries, and launch cooperation initiatives across a broad range of sectors, including health, business, technology, education, security, and agriculture. There have only been two other peace agreements with Israel in the last 72 years, said President Trump, and I am very hopeful that there will be more to follow. Indeed, the agreements with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates also helped to advance prospects for finding a fair and lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians. After decades of instability and crisis, conditions in the Middle East have improved significantly over the last 3 years, said President Trump.
I've restored trust with our regional partners, and together we've eliminated the ISIS caliphate 100%. Isolated the radicals who pervert Islam and sow instability. Today, nations across the region and throughout the world are joining together, united in their determination to build a better future, free from the evils which perpetuate terror.
President Trump thanked the leaders of Israel and Bahrain for their courage to forge this historic agreement.
Their leadership is proving that the future can be filled with hope and does not need to be predetermined by conflicts of the past. As more countries normalize relations with Israel, which will happen quite quickly, we believe, the region will become more and more stable, secure, and prosperous.
The United States will continue to stand with the people of the Middle East as they work to build a brighter, more hopeful future.
That was an editorial reflecting